Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, the Compass podcast. I'm Neil Lawson, your host and director of Compass. These are unprecedented times, and we need to rise to the new and enormous challenges we now face. Over the next few weeks, we'll be speaking with writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists, and public service workers about how we come out of this mess in much better shape than we went in, a good society after COVID-19. These conversations have live access for Compass members who can put their own questions directly to our guests. If you'd like to participate in the live call and help support all of our work, go to compassonline.org.uk/podcast to join Compass today. Otherwise, sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's podcast. Welcome to this week's Compass podcast, which is about the Conservatives. How do we understand them to beat them? And to understand them, we're going to use the thinking of the long-dead Italian socialist theorist called Antonio Gramsci. And to understand both Gramsci and Johnsonism, I'm delighted to introduce this week's podcast guest, Professor Ken Spurs. Ken is a long-time student of Gramsci and a former member of the Communist Party before switching his allegiances to Labour. Ken is now Emeritus Professor of Education at UCL, where he worked for many years in the old Institute of Education on 16 to 19 education policy at the very highest levels. Ken has been a stalwart of Compass, first running the Compass Education Group, which did some groundbreaking work in the run-up to the 2017 general election. And since then, he's helped us enormously in our understanding of the Conservative Party with his reports on the Osborne supremacy and more recently shapeshifters. And the conversation we're going to go through tonight with Ken and you is going to lead to a new iteration of that analysis and a new report on where the Conservatives are now. Ken's been fantastic around Compass. He's helped me enormously, been a great comrade of mine. But he's also been brilliant at mentoring our staff and helping with our general research output. So, Ken, it's great to have you here tonight. And before I hand over to Ken with the first question, just to note that the 8th of June is a notable date in the life and world of Compass. 4 years ago, the general election 2017, when we first ran the Progressive Alliance, and we think had an impact, we know had an impact in over 30 constituencies, were very close to toppling the Tories' majority. And my word, the world would have been different if we had managed that. Next time, we're going to manage much more. But we'll manage much more if we understand our enemy. And as I said, to understand our enemy, we're going to use the thinking of Gramsci, who many of you will have heard of. Many of you may not have read the whole of the prison notebooks that he wrote while being in prison under Mussolini in a cryptic code. Ken has read them. He has thought about them. So, Ken, over to you to go through first. Tell us who Gramsci was and why he mattered.
Antonio Gramsci was an Italian communist who lived between 1891 and 1937. He was born in Sardinia, and so he understood the south of Italy, and that was to be an important theme. Understanding the division between north and south in Italy was, in fact, a very important part of his kind of national understanding. He joined the Italian Socialist Party in 1913 and was involved with the Turin Workers' Councils in 1920 and helped form the Italian Communist Party in 1921 and became its general secretary in 1924. He backed an anti-fascist popular front. So here we are, the first evidence of alliance building in his work. He was a member of parliament for the PCI in 1924 and was arrested in 1926 by the fascists, by Mussolini. And the prosecutor at his trial stated, for 20 years, we must stop this brain from functioning. Well, it didn't succeed because while he was in prison, Gramsci wrote a total of 30 prison notebooks, 3,000 pages of writing and analysis, which were published in Italian in the 1950s and then in English in the early 1970s. And really what his work in prison particularly reflected was reflections on the defeat of revolutions in the West compared with successful Bolshevik revolutions. And it's this, and what he gives us, and this is what I want to talk about, he gives us a Marxist political theory. Before that, there was not a Marxist political theory. Even, I don't think Lenin was responsible for a Marxist political theory. So he gives us a number of key concepts that help us understand how the ruling class rules, not just through force, but through consent. And that is absolutely crucial. And what I want to do this evening is to use a number of his key concepts in order to explain conservative hegemony. Gramsci, if you look at his work overall, he develops around about 10 related concepts which form the corpus of his political theory. I'm not going to go through all of them. I want to look at tonight hegemony, historical bloc, common sense, passive revolution, war of position, war of maneuver, and conjunctural analysis. There are others on state, civil society, political party, organic intellectuals. That's for another conversation. So I'm really looking at the political strategic aspects of his work in order to understand how a particular political force, in this case, the Conservatives, have been able to develop a very durable electoral bloc, which has lasted for 5 years. They haven't gone below 40%, yeah, in 5 years, which is absolutely remarkable. But in doing this, I want to actually try to locate Gramsci in the UK context. And that means actually looking at the work of Stuart Hall. I'd like to think that the work that I've undertaken on the Conservatives is in his tradition. I'm certainly not his intellectual equal. He was, in fact, an outstanding figure, the greatest Black left intellectual I think we've had in the 20th century. And what Stuart Hall did was that in 1979, through Marxism Today, I'll say a bit more about that in a minute, he wrote The Great Moving Right Show, which was really looking at the beginnings of Thatcherism. He then develops his understanding of Gramsci's relevance to the UK context in his work on Gramsci and Us in 1987. And then crucially, in the early noughties, in 2003, he published his work on the double shuffle. And I want to come back to this because I believe that his final contribution was possibly his most telling in terms of helping us to understand how, in fact, a political force can do two things at once.
Okay, and then we're going to end up with what is a version of a progressive left double shuffle.
Yes,
we'll explain what that term means in a bit. So let's start with some of those key concepts. So people have, and I get them confused. So this is really helpful for me as well. And if anyone's wondering, you know, again, why this kind of, you know, nearly 100 years ago, this matters. You may recall that only last year, Michael Gove made a speech which was entirely based on a Gramscian notion of political change and political struggle. It was an incredibly kind of banal, superficial use of Gramsci. But even Michael Gove recognised that this person is probably, you know, the preeminent change theorist, you know, of the last 200 years. So Ken, back over to you and run us through some of those key concepts and so help us understand them and their relevance today.
Yes, I said that I was going to cover half a dozen of them. Let's start with hegemony. Hegemony is the overarching concept. Hegemony is the idea of rule through the combined effects of consent and coercion. Previously, in Marxist theory, it was based on coercion, dictatorship of the proletariat. Gramsci's concept of hegemony moves away from the notion of purely using force because he observed that the Western revolutions did not impact because the bourgeoisie in the West in the 20th century had developed levels of democracy and developed levels of consent. So this idea of a dual concept of consent coercion is incredibly important. There are different approaches to Gramsci. Some theorists emphasize the consent coercion integral state side more than others. I tend to use them together. So that's the overarching concept. The second one is the idea of building a historical bloc. Gramsci argues that a ruling class is able to rule because it builds what historical bloc really is about, a building of a complex system of alliances. They're economic, they are political, they are ideological, and the ideas, you line them up, you try to create the alignment between different layers of these alliances. And that's where the role of organic intellectuals come into, but I'm not going to talk about them so much tonight. I want to also just alight very lightly on his notion of common sense. Now, Gramsci's concept of common sense is very different from the English rendition of common sense. Common sense in England is a form of what we call rationality. For Gramsci, common sense was a form of popular belief, a sense in which a person tries to understand the world, but does so in a relatively incoherent way. And he contrasts that with good sense, which is more systematic. The fourth concept is a one of change called passive revolution. Now, Gramsci was interested, obviously, in active participatory revolution, but he observed that the ruling class rules by incorporating some of the energies of the subordinate class in order to bring about enough change to as a stave off. The ruling class absorbs some of the energies of the working class by taking some of its ideas and incorporating these into their framework. But they do it in such a manner that the process is passive, that people remain passive. They're not activated. They don't participate in the sense that we would want. So passive revolution is an incredibly important concept because I'm going to refer to it when I talk about Tory adaptiveness. Fifthly, I want to talk briefly about the strategies of change, war of position, war of manoeuvre. Gramsci observed that the Bolshevik Revolution really was war of manoeuvre. You know, basically stormed the Winter Palace, took over telephone exchanges. In a sense, the war of manoeuvre is literally like a frontal charge. But Gramsci observed that the ruling class in the West ruled not just by those wars of manoeuvre, because there are those elements. It was a fundamental war of position, which was ideological warfare and political warfare, which he characterized as trench warfare, using the analogies of the First World War, because he lived through it. He said, actually, the war of position and the cementing of hegemony was through trench warfare. And he said that the bourgeoisie were very, very good at this, and they used a whole range of forces in order to, as it were, expedite this political trench warfare. Finally, I want to have a look at this term conjunctural, because Gramsci makes a distinction between conjunctural and organic developments. Organic developments are the deeper ones, the tectonic ones at the base of society. The conjunctural ones, on the other hand, is really the political plane, the political ideological terrain in which organic developments erupt. Now, what Gramsci says is, I think he's hinting in the Prison Notebooks, if in fact a political force is able to work with agility at the conjunctural level, it can postpone the organic contradictions. And I want to come back to this because it's terribly important in understanding why, in fact, the conservatives seem to wriggle out of apparent contradictions with ease, yeah, because of their understanding of the conjunctural. So there, Neil, are the six: hegemony, historical bloc and alliances, common sense, passive revolution, war of position, war of manoeuvre, and conjunctural compared with organic developments. I'm going to apply them soon to, in fact, Tory political practice.
Okay, and so let me just reprise in my simplistic, non-theoretical language. So we've got a political project which builds consent for its project, that builds up a ruling bloc, which isn't just about winning an electoral majority, but having forces in civil society, in the media, in universities, in business, that sees a big picture of politics, not just electoral, that to build that hegemony has a popular belief system which underpins that, which co-opts the ideas of the alternative bloc, in this case, the left bloc, wherever it can, and we'll maybe get onto the red wall and how they've co-opted the thinking and voters in the red wall, that uses complex systems of position. And this is, you know, how do you get around the back of the conservatives? How do you get inside them? How do you find the cracks and open up the differences in their block? That's what we have to be thinking about, not how do you just oppose them electorally. And then how do you operate on a day-to-day basis in a flexible, agile, but purposeful ways, which repositions your politics and your values against, you know, what may be overwhelming odds, but because you can do it agilely, you know, and effectively, then, you know, you can beat the system, which is what the Conservatives keep doing. On the basis of that, you know, that run through, Ken, where do we think, you know, the Tories are now? Give us a bit of a sweep of, you know, the last 10 years that you've been writing about in terms of the Tories and their shift through different phases to where they are now.
Well, I want to just talk about four themes, and I will then try and relate them to the concepts that you've just clarified. First, the Conservatives are incredibly politically adaptable. We called it of late shape-shifting, and Johnson as a personal shape-shifter. But Johnsonism, let's just accept for the minute that there is a thing called Johnsonism. We'll debate this, but I think it's worth thinking about a particular phase of conservatism that has arisen since 2016. But the first shape-shifting was really Cameron's liberal conservatism between 2005 and Cameronism, Osborneism, and the Osborne supremacy, between 2005 and 2016, in which it established itself as a response to the 2008 crash and austerity as the means of recovery. That is then replaced by an interregnum, which is May's, what Nick Pearce refers to, Theresa May's soft nationalism. But of course, she embodies so many contradictions. Ultimately, that is then replaced by the much harder Brexit English nationalist approach, of Johnson. So this is the third shapeshift within 15 years. And it's remarkable. And this latest phase certainly lasts, it originates in what might call the Brexit window in 2016. So you have adaptability there at the conjunctural level, at the level of politics and ideology. Then what the right does is it frames the political environment. It creates the Brexit window. And you've got to understand that the Conservatives also pulled upon the patient ideological warfare of Farageism over the previous decade or more. And then with Cummings brought in, the war of manoeuvre within this overall war of position was the summing up with the simple but resonant slogan, get Brexit done, and actually winning that EU referendum. So the EU referendum is a war of manoeuvre. It's not violent, it's full of a blizzard of lies, but nevertheless, the patient build-up is then executed by a decisive political act. What happened then? If you look at the polls then, you see that what was UKIP and the Brexit Party polling very well, and the decision of the Conservatives is that they have to, in fact, go into some kind of alliance with Farageism and then to absorb it, a bit like the spectres in Philip Pullman's novels, pulling the life out of the Brexit Party. And so you have the formation of what we've termed in Compass the Regressive Alliance. And that is the bedrock of the 40% plus bloc that has endured since 2016. So there's bloc building going on. And I think we should have a really interesting discussion around the anatomy of that bloc socially and politically. Johnson said, I think a couple of days ago, that he thought narratives were everything. And in one sense, at the conjunctural level, he's right, that the Conservatives are incredibly good at telling a story. And that is global Britain taking back control, levelling up, people's priorities. I mean, they have these slogans which actually match together, despite all the contradictions which I'll come to. And they are meant to secure and keep the political bloc together. So these are the kind of conjunctural strategies that they use. Shape-shifting is a form of passive revolution. You have the active framing of political environments, you've got alliance building, and then you've got the narratives which form the basis of appeal and consent.
They're doing clever political strategy, as if they'd absorbed Gramsci. So take us back to Stuart Hall and his analysis in the early noughties of New Labour and introduce the concept of the double shuffle, Ken, before we then apply that to the Conservatives. And let me tell you that I read this chapter or essay that he'd written in a brilliant journal that is still around called Soundings, that some of you will know about, and you should subscribe to Soundings. And literally, I'll just tell you the story quickly. I was on a train going to South Wales to try and contest a seat in the kind of high point of New Labour to become a New Labour MP. And I read Stuart Hall on the train on the way down there, and it had such an impact on me. I got off the train, I went over the bridge and got the train back to London because I just thought, he's so right. I don't want to be a part of this project. Now explain to people, Ken, what the double shuffle said, and then let's apply it to the Conservatives.
In the early noughties, Stuart Hall's reflecting on New Labour, and he used the metaphor of the double shuffle, which is in fact a dance movement of large movements and smaller movements in dance. I haven't personally done it, but that's where the metaphor
I'd like to see it.
So the double shuffle is suggesting as a concept that two things are going on. And what Stuart Hall, reflecting on Blair and New Labour, said that actually the dominant discourse in New Labour was neoliberal. And this was witnessed by Tony Blair's kind of, you know, acknowledgement of the power of Thatcherism, and that the subordinate part was social democracy. Now, this idea of a dominant subordinate gave two reflections. First of all, it helped understand, in fact, the erosion or the degeneration of New Labour, but also that New Labour wasn't simply Toryism. It was, in fact, a very particular combination. Now, we can debate how dominant the New Liberal part was and how subordinate the Social Democratic part was, but the fact that Hall points to a double movement, because he then says the dominant part drives the programme, the subordinate part tries to extend appeal. And that's very, very important to understand the distinction between the two functions. If we then take the double shuffle away from New Labour and use it as a general political theory, we can then apply it to other political forces. Stuart Hall didn't apply it to Conservatives. I have, because I think it's a very incredibly useful concept. So let us now apply the double shuffle concept to the Conservatives. The dominant strand that drives regressive political change are as follows. Neoliberal deregulation, reducing the cost for capital. Absolutely central to Brexit. Yeah? That, in fact, the idea of rejecting the EU was rejecting coordinated capitalism and wanting a much more kind of neoliberal type capitalism. Secondly, populist English nationalism and nativism, absorbing, this is the Farageism that's absorbed into the Conservative lexicon, and which in fact provides the driving force behind the Brexit era. And then we have authoritarianism, an anti-democratic strategy to cement electoral advantage. And we are seeing some of those now in terms of boundary changes, suppression of voting, so on, and voter identity and so on. So we have the dominant parts, okay? And the combination of those have changed since Cameron Osborneism. But the subordinate parts, which are meant to extend political appeal and in this case consolidate red wall gains, are a mild Keynesianism, levelling up, and investment away from London. I mean, they'll do as little as possible, by the way, right? But it's there in the rhetoric. Promises of public spending on NHS, policing and schools, people's priorities, and the rhetoric of one nation conservatism. So we have to understand, therefore, the constant evolution and combination of these dominant and subordinate strands. The thing about Johnson is, because he has the shapeshifter persona, he's able to combine and work with these things. I don't think he sat down and reads Gramsci, possibly like Gove has done. He does this instinctively. I don't think they really think this through in some ways. I think it's far more effortless that they're able to weave the dominant and subordinate parts according to the way that they perceive the political wind. And that is really the basis of their hegemony. We have to work incredibly hard to think things through. That's not to say that Conservatives don't have think tanks and they don't do the research, but I do believe their hegemony and their combination of politics is more effortless, another form of passive revolution. That's what it is.
So that's the strength of their position. What are the kind of contradictions and therefore the weaknesses in all of that that we can begin to exploit if we want to build decrease the size and power of their bloc and increase the size and power of our bloc?
Before I go through the short-term and longer-term tensions and contradictions, I just want to make the point that I've done this before. And when I look back at my previous publications, I list these tensions and contradictions, and then I find that actually they haven't come to pass. So I'm going to give you a health warning before I go into this list, because political and ideological agility means that actually a political force can postpone, yes, or displace short-term conjunctural contradictions. Not organic ones, I don't think, but conjunctural ones. Okay, so let's go through these now. And I just want to, these people recognize that this is nothing new here. First of all, the Conservative bloc has a fundamental fragility because of the tension between its investment strategy and neoliberal austerity. And that's going to be played out between Johnson and Sunak, right? That, in fact, they won't be able to resist the imposition of austerity again, no matter what he says. The economy, stupid, is going to be there right at the center post-COVID. In this, the bloc, the Brexit-defined political blocs, at odds with important sections of capital, particularly capital that is dependent on seamlessness in terms of trade. Now, this again hasn't come. This hasn't come to fruition. I mean, it's, you know, despite Calais being chocked up, the fact of the matter is through the pandemic and what have you, you know, the political tensions with other parts of capital haven't manifested themselves yet. On the other hand, because of bringing the UK out of the EU, it's basically put England at odds with Scotland. This is more serious. I'm not sure whether Scottish independence will actually come about, but there is really tensions which in fact could bring about, well, certainly will weaken, if not threaten, the Union. And there's also some tensions as a result of Biden's win in the United States. Had Trump won in the United States, won the election, Johnson would have thought he's going with the tide. Now it doesn't look like that. You've got Democrats in the White House, although not with a very usable majority. You've got EU, which looks far more kind of centrist overall than Johnson, than the Conservatives. So I think there are things really building up here. The question really is how that's going to be exposed. The longer term contradictions, I think, are far more serious for them. And that is the social composition of the Conservative bloc, which is particularly dependent on older voters, is incapable of modernization. It simply does not tap into the sources of economic and cultural energy that you have in cities. Now, I don't think Labour's made much of this, actually. The Tories' political bloc is what Nick Pearce calls a holding bloc. It's a holding pattern. It's not actually building a vibrant set of social and political forces. It's a holding pattern based upon, actually, in a sense, bribes because of triple lock and all of that. And it's on the wrong end of cultural, economic and environmental thinking. I mean, if you compare what's happening now to the 1980s, in the 1980s, you were seeing the remorseless rise of neoliberalism. We're not seeing that now. We are seeing disaster capitalism or whatever. The long-term trends are now becoming far more progressive. And the Tories are at the wrong end of it. And they're going to have to make adaptions to it. The question will be, they will try and make adaptions. They will try to be part of it, well, without being serious. So then the issue, and we're going to come to it, is that those contradictions are only going to be really laid bare by wider social movements, political alliances, and a progressive bloc that really starts to move with the tide of the tectonic changes.
Well, let's just get onto that finally before we hand it over to Gabriel and people to ask their questions. But they have built a bloc which goes from the blue rinse to the red wall, won a majority of 80. Why have the progressive left got it so wrong, Ken?
I think the defeats, and their successive defeats, remember, are not simply down to the imbalance of economic and political forces. Yes, there are imbalances. The Conservatives, despite actually, you know, and capitalism, despite being a minority social force, has been able to generate sufficient wealth and influence to, in fact, carry the day. And also, we have to acknowledge the agility of the adversary. By the way, I term the Conservatives adversaries, not enemies. I mean, Mouffe and Erajon made a distinction between adversary and enemy. Adversary is somebody who actually does play, at least by democratic rules, enemies do not. So fascists are enemies. A Conservative Party that is willing, that in fact is remotely democratic, is regarded as an adversary. I think the reasons for the left defeat over and above balance of forces are that I don't think the left understands politics. I think the far left and certainly traditional Marxists is economically rooted. It doesn't have a sense of political theory. Social democracy, I don't think, has a strong intellectual tradition. And therefore, it's not surprising when you think about the far left social democracy that there hasn't been, in fact, a sufficiently live intellectual tradition, bar kind of Marxism today, some of the work that's going around Compass or Democracy elsewhere. But this is not characterizing the left. The left is not really a thinking political strategic force. And it also just doesn't seem to understand conjuncture. It doesn't understand the terrain of politics on which the adversary practices. We conduct politics as if the adversary is not there. And this is why I've always been interested in battlefield analogies. I mean, I know feminist comrades will say, Ken, will you stop going on about war? Yeah, warfare analogies. But warfare analogies are quite, and Gramsci used them extensively, reflecting on the First World War. Warfare analogies, the idea there's a field of warfare and your adversary is there and you've got to understand what your adversary is doing in order to overcome them. I don't think that actually has been really understood by the left at all. And that's the reason for the work that I've done. Okay, and therefore, it's really important to understand the dimensions of conservative hegemony and to match these while not imitating the conservative project.
And then finally, quickly, just on what a progressive left double shuffle is, just give us quickly what that entails, Ken.
I think we've got, they have a dominant narrative. We have to have a deep change narrative, which is not about an isolated Britain, but as an interdependent country leading on climate change. We've got to have a deep narrative that reflects the movements that we want. And this is why I think that Starmerism, just having the flag, wasn't enough. It was imitating the narrative of the Conservatives. We have to develop our own deep narrative. I'll come back to this idea of what this might actually mean in terms of traditionalism. The regressive alliance has to be matched by a progressive alliance. I mean, the idea that one political party can win this by itself is crazy. It just will not happen. We have to have our own combination of politics. They have the regressive double shuffle. Now, is there a progressive double shuffle? Yes, well, I think there is. The dominant part is democratic modernization and the subordinate part is traditionalism. Not the other way around. Starmerism comes across as traditionalism. But actually, the dominant part has to be, I think, the modernization of the country and participation. At the same time, the traditional, for instance, would be really understanding a sense of place. And I think Lisa Nandy has this, by the way. And I think Andy Burnham has this. That's very interesting. They articulate the tradition through a sense of place. I think democratization, the Tories' authoritarianism and anti-democratic strategy has to be countered by profoundly democratization strategy of electoral reform, citizens assemblies. Compass has, got done irons of work on this. And finally, shape-shifting. I think leaders on the left have got to try to embody the persona of the progressive double shuffle, right? They have to have themselves a complex political persona that has a very open face, but has depth to it.
I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. It's Bloody Complicated is brought to you by Compass and is made possible by the support of our amazing members, like Clive. Here's Clive on why he joined the Compass community.
My name's Clive Lewis. I'm a Labour MP for Norwich South. I've been involved with Compass for 7 years or more and a member for a few years now. My involvement with Compass first started because it was the first left-wing organisation I saw that was really pushing forward the environmental agenda. This was years ahead of anything that was being talked about in Labour at the time, and I thought it was fantastic. I keep supporting Compass today because it's a refuge, in a political environment which, to be quite frank, is extremely tribal, it's extremely difficult. It's the culture of Compass. It's about asking difficult questions and acknowledging that there will be differences. But actually, those differences are a strength, not a weakness. You can be in any faction of the Labour Party or any faction of the Green Party or the Liberal Democrats or any other progressive organisation or in no political party, just someone who's interested in the world around them and want to see the world change for the better. It's where I get my political sustenance from, and it means a lot to me to be a part of that community, and that's why I would wholeheartedly endorse it to you.
Find out more about joining the Compass community at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And now, back to the conversation.
Fantastic, fantastic. That's been super helpful for me, and I help the members on the call and the listeners later in the week. Gabriel, over to you. Get some questions in.
Great. Thanks, Neil. Yeah, we've got some really, really good questions for Ken already, so we'll take a group of them together. First up, we've got one from Deb Joffe.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Ken how much you partly answered this, actually. How much of this on the part of the right is conscious and deliberate? A conspiracy, as it were, and how much of it is just instinctive and sort of galvanised by their ruthlessness.
Okay, next up, we had a question on Boris Johnson himself from Joe Sargent.
Hi, yeah, I mean, my question was really that I question that Johnson has any kind of personal ideology, and he just shifts his position according to who holds the balance of power in the Tory party. Some of the things that are happening sound to me as though it's Jacob Rees-Mogg that's yanking his chain. But he got rid of Sajid Javid at the beginning of COVID so that he could bring in Rishi Sunak, who's a bit more happy to spend money. Whereas my impression is that Sajid Javid is a more of an Ayn Rand monetarist.
Thanks, Joe. Okay, should we take one more in this round? We've got a question on Gramsci and common sense from Jack.
So I was wondering whether you could explain the distinction that Gramsci makes between common sense and good sense. And I was wondering whether you could also tell us why it is that the Conservatives seemed so successful in tapping into this sense, the common sense, and constructing arguments that seem to tap into it, and why the left seemed so bad at that.
Thanks, Jack.
Okay. So in response to the first on the relation between instinct and conspiracy, well, first of all, the Conservatives do have an intellectual tradition, and they do have a close relationship between think tanks and the parliamentary Conservative Party. And yes, there will be, you know, there will be discussions behind closed doors in clubs and what have you. But I think that their hegemony is managed to build and shift and develop without a great deal of, as it were, discussion and thought. So in that sense, I think we just got to look at both of those and how, in fact, I mean, at one level, I think we should look at the inner workings of how they produce ideas. At the same time, the more effortless hegemony comes from having built, patiently built, a war of position. As for Johnson himself, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the contributor because, you know, he carries convictions very lightly. I do think deep down he is neoliberal, but he appreciates, he has come to appreciate the kind of the nativism of the Brexit idea. I mean, in many ways, Johnson's current persona was actually shaped by Cummings. You know, losing Cummings was actually quite a blow. The issue here is not just Johnson. Johnson is there as almost like a mediator. I think here we should think much more about the Conservatives as shapeshifters, not just Johnson as a shapeshifter, although we have to see them at the moment together. On this distinction between common sense and good sense, now this is actually very, very important because it's a way of getting away from the Marxist concept of false consciousness. Gramsci was incredibly interested in the little conservatisms of the South. And the question he asked was, why didn't the southern peasantry ally with the northern working class in the Italian Revolution of 1920? And therefore, what he was looking at was, in fact, people's everyday perceptions, and therefore his concept of common sense, and Stuart Hall incidentally has written some work on this with a co-author. He talks about the idea of common sense being incoherent, a set of ideas that kind of sediment. His distinction then was between, well, he makes it good sense. He was talking about a more literate member of the working class, a person who was able to, through education, to think things through more systematically. So clear, critical, common, good sense was, he saw good sense as a step towards science. So good sense is the idea of a certain form of criticality. It begins, first of all, with a form of skepticism, but it goes beyond skepticism. Common sense can lead to a depth of skepticism, a distrust of everything, whereas good sense has got to be one of the aims of education. His ultimate distinction was between good sense and science, and of course he said as well, obviously, you know, good sense can proceed then to a scientific view of the world, historicism, and not least of all, theory of Marxism.
Very good. Next batch, Gabriel.
Okay, we've got three more that I think go very well together. To kick us off, we're going to go to Margaret Lynch.
Whilst Johnson is a constant shapeshifter, but he also constantly lies. How do you deal with that sort of how do you deal with it without lying yourself, you know?
Next up, we've got Barbara Clark.
Hello. My question was just very simply, why do the Tories manage to persuade the people who they are really operating against to vote for them?
It's a great question. And last, I'm going to go to Kieran Breen.
My question is, a lot of this talk so far, it suggests to me now that citizens are, you know, passive subjects manipulated by sort of cunning, savvy PR political parties. Could it just be a case that quite simply, you know, they have got agency and they just simply disagree with Labour more often than they disagree with the Tories?
Over to you, Ken.
Okay, right. Margaret, the issue around lies. If Gramsci was writing today, it'd be fascinating what he would make of Trump, yeah? Trumpism. And what he would make of a digital world. Because remember, he wrote he wrote under extremely difficult conditions in prison at almost 100 years ago. The issue about lying is really, I think, the root of that as a form of consensus making is an issue around cynicism. And that what the right has done is to try and degrade people's belief in politics per se. So, you know, everybody's at it, right? There's no virtue to be had in political life. And so when you engender that kind of cynicism, then in fact, somebody can lie through the back teeth. And if that person is also seen not to be political, but seen to have a celebrity status, you know, to be anti-politics, then the so-called normal, the normal rules of politics don't apply to them. So I think the challenge here is obviously not to lie back. I think it points to the idea of a decent, what I've termed radical decency, an open, decent political project which does make virtue of truth and of evidence, but also is able to storytell around those things. You're not going to persuade people through a kind of a seminar like this. I mean, this is being conducted at a particular level for you know, a very particular form of participation. So it's to actually think about the political process and the democratic process as something that really needs to be developed, preserved, and to have what I call ethical political. That what the left needs is an ethical political strategy, not just a political strategy, in order to combat the lack of ethics on the other side. Barbara's point about persuading people yet acting against their interests is a fundamental question. Because Marxists, if they were traditional Marxists, would be scratching their heads and just saying, well, it's false consciousness on behalf of the working class. But what I think conservative hegemonic practice does is, on the one hand, it appeals to people's cultural identities, that people exist not just materially, they exist as cultural beings. And for instance, I'm now in Weardale, I'm very near Barnet Castle, where I go for an eyesight test every day. Actually, I'm very near Bishop Auckland, okay? I'm very near the area that's in the Red Wall seats. And if you're in Bishop Auckland and you've seen your town go down the pan over the last 30, 40 years, right? And it's had a Labour council, right? And the Labour council's never had the power to do anything, but nevertheless, the people don't understand that. And at the same time, you then wonder why, in fact, your life has changed. And somebody turns around and says, actually, it's somebody else's fault. It's the EU and their regulations stopped us from actually becoming great. What, in fact, the Tories do is they appeal, their conjunctural strategy is, in fact, on the one hand, a dominantly cultural. It's culture wars. But at the same time, they have to do enough in order to persuade people that they have their economic interests at heart. And that's why you get the rhetoric around levelling up. But the point about the double shuffle is that they can't actually spend the money to level up. So that will always be subordinate. What we will find is that the Conservative double shuffle will always be dominated by culture wars. And then the economic is the subordinate to it. The Kieran's point about that, really, the working class is not passive. It has more agency, just doesn't agree with Labour. First of all, it's very important not to view the working class or the working classes or the array of social groups that we have under neoliberalism as simply passive. They can be agentic in different ways. People are incredibly active socially, in terms of volunteering, but this doesn't translate itself into political activity. So, for instance, you know, the number of people who are really interested in political news is about, 15-20%? Of the population. So I think it's important to look at people's agency and to look at their agencies and then think, how can that be developed, linked to other things? And that's why it's very important that the left has a kind of active social dimension, not just political dimension. And there will be, in fact, sections of society that actually think Labour has not, in fact, really risen to the plate. And I think that the sudden decline of Starmerism would point to the fact that certain younger sections may have already lost faith in Labour as a transformatory force. So there's something in what you say.
Great. Thanks, Ken. Last, we're going to go to Nick Holliday for a practical question on what progressives do next.
I think it's been fascinating stuff. But one of the things that caught my ear when you were talking, Ken, was that you said something like, and I may have this slightly wrong, but I think it's along the right lines, you suggest that the Tories are at the wrong end of socio-environmental trends, which I've then interpreted to be, in inverted commas, their soft underbelly. You also went on to say that progressives must ally, and I assume we must ally to exploit this weakness. And I've got two questions for you, really. Have we got time to do this before, say, early 2023? And what are the three critical success factors that you would submit that we have to achieve in order to do that?
Whoa, and this is at 1858, a question like this. Thank you, Nick. In Gramscian terms, in terms of conjuncture organic trends, the Conservatives are at the wrong end of organic tradition, if in fact we win conjunctural battles. And therefore, the key things between now and 2024 is that, first of all, I think the Labour Party has to open itself up to the idea of cooperation with other political forces. Secondly, that it has to understand, and also other political parties, have got to try and root themselves in communities and be an active social force as well as a political force, so people can understand that they do make a difference. And thirdly, I think that we have to support the very active movements in civil society that are going to come back again after the pandemic, Extinction Rebellion, the environmental movements in particular, I think are going to be incredibly important. The battles around our place in the world and aid, these are going to be incredibly important. The Conservatives have soft underbellies. And the soft underbelly of the Conservatives is ethics. And that's why if the left can be seen as an ethical political force and not just as a political force, then it will start to, I think, become far more attractive to a lot more people, and there may be some hope in 2024. But it will not be, we will not get anywhere by left sectionalism, tribalism, sectarianism. We've been there before, done that, failed.
Fantastic, Ken, and fantastic questions from all of us. That was really tremendous. I learned a huge amount from that, and I hope everyone did. So thank you so much, Ken, for your time and all your work over the years, getting that depth of understanding and knowledge. Our next call is on the 22nd of June, where we'll be marking unbelievably 5 years since the Brexit referendum. To help us make sense of that huge event and its repercussions today, we'll be joined by the Labour MP, John Trickett, a Guardian journalist, Zoe Williams, and the writer and author, Anthony Barnett. So that will be a really interesting podcast in 2 weeks' time, so do join us for that. Until then, thanks again, Ken. That was brilliant. Thanks to all our members on the call and your questions. And as ever, please keep safe and keep hopeful. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So, if you like what you've heard today and want to be part of a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And you'll be able to join us live on future calls just like this one. You can tweet me at Neil, N-E-A-L, underscore Compass, or Compass at Compass Office. And if you've enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. And it's only fair that they know it's bloody complicated too.